Your Mouth podcast, about phrase etymology and why we say the things we say. I'm Milo.
And I'm Dave.
He's my dad.
And she is my daughter.
That's how that works. Spooky season.
Ooh, a little add-on for the spooky season. Very nice.
For a moment, I was thinking about doing the intro in spooky voice, and then I panicked and bailed. So if you heard a moan of hesitation, listener, before I did the normal intro, it's because I was very considering going, hello and welcome, but decided to be not that obnoxious.
Well, maybe that wasn't a bad call. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm learning restraint in some ways.
Well, good, good. I've been meaning to talk to you about that, but thankfully you're picking it up on your own.
Yeah, that's part of growing up, I guess.
It is.
Do you have a good spooky voice?
Nope. I used to do a mad scientist laugh that I thought was pretty good. It was pretty legit back in the day.
You want to back off the mic and give me one of those? That's pretty good.
Not bad, right?
Yeah. I was talking to my sister the other day about how in middle school I had to play the big bad wolf and I was supposed to do a wolf howl at the end. And I was too shy and couldn't. So it was the saddest little strangled wolf howl. Even though I was the villain, it was like, oh.
You got to really commit to that. And that's even when I see some bad acting or someone's got to do something that's just, there's some things, if you don't fully embrace it and lean into it, it just becomes cringeworthy. And sometimes even when they fully lean into it, it's still cringeworthy, but at least they're owning it and going for it. That's hard to do.
It is, because you worry about being cringy. So you kind of hold off, but then that can create more cringe because you're not like giving it your all. And if you give it your all, you'll actually push through. But yeah, I imagine it's like the Kool-Aid man trying to go through a brick wall. And, you know, if you hit it too soft, you'll just shatter. But if you really go for it, you go all the way through.
That's right. And he's just, maybe he had some, but I think once he shatters, he's dead, right? I mean, maybe there's not like, is there a race of Kool-Aid men? Is there like a lot of them and they're learning from each other's mistakes, or is there just one?
I mean, there's probably multiple, because they're all like, there's different colors and like flavors and stuff. So either that's like him changing his outfits, or it's a whole range of them.
Could be.
But yeah, speaking of terrifying oversized beasts, today we're going to speak of the devil.
Speaking of the devil.
That is the phrase we're going over today. Speak of the devil.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Tell me about it, Milo.
We are pretty well into spooky season by now, and I've been thinking about Satan, as I often do. No, mostly because I was watching Midnight Mass, that new very popular show.
Oh my goodness, I've heard about it.
You would not like it.
No, they didn't make that for me.
No. So we're talking of the devil.
Yes. Go ahead
and
try that.
We're speaking of the devil, and by speaking of the devil, we're speaking of speak of the devil, which is a very common and quite old phrase. Is it one that you use often?
Nope, I do not. But yeah, certainly I'm aware of it. I've heard of it.
Okay. Do you have like a moral objection to using it, or is this not one that's part of your everyday use?
I don't know that I have a moral objection. Certainly not a moral objection to it, but I don't know. I think I actually said it today or yesterday. I said it very recently, and it just seemed. And of course, I said it in an ironic way.
Yes.
You know, like speak of the devil, and doesn't seem like a very nice thing to say about somebody.
Interesting. Okay. See, I found that quite a bit in the research, that it's kind of like an unkindness because you're referring to somebody as the devil, but I never thought of it that way. I always just thought of it as, you know, you're just saying, oh, what a coincidence. But yeah, for those who don't know, speak of the devil is a shortened version of a full phrase, speak of the devil and he doth appear. Basically meaning that if you start talking about the devil, he's going to show up. Or if you're talking about something bad, it's going to appear. You're kind of going to tempt fate, as it were.
you're going to speak it into existence, if yes. I guess.
So people, at least here in the US, will often use it if they're talking about somebody and they just happen to call, or they happen to walk by and be like, oh, speak of the devil, it's you. Yep. So I typically don't see it in like a negative context, and I use it quite a bit and never in like a negative way, like, oh shoot, here comes the devil. But
well, here comes Satan incarnate.
Yes. Well, he hasn't been returning my calls, so
he'll be like that. He's busy.
Despite the devil being a very old concept, this phrase is a little bit more recent, but not by much. It comes from England in the Middle Ages, so it stretches back pretty far, although back then they meant it in a more literal sense. There was an actual fear that because of the power of names and because the devil is always watching and waiting to pounce, it could very literally mean, hey, if you start talking about evil, he's going to start showing up and causing some problems. The older version is actually talk of the devil and presently he's at your elbow, which is kind of imagines you're gonna like do a little dance with the devil, which is cute, I guess.
Is he playing the fiddle in this dance?
I think that imagery comes in a little bit later, because I don't know if there's a lot of fiddles in this time, but
well,
who knows?
They're lost.
Yeah. And then in 1672, there was a poem which said, talk of the devil, see his horns, which I think is kind of a cute way of putting that.
Sure.
But nowadays, of course, we do not use it in an actual literal sense. It's not usually a superstition for people anymore, despite the fact that in a lot of media, we have characters like in Harry Potter's Voldemort, like if you say the evil thing's name, it's going to give the evil some kind of power over you.
Yep.
Most people don't believe in that anymore, but the phrase still stuck around, which I think is kind of fun. So I have very long been interested in the history of the way we think about Satan and just like the figure of the big bad devil.
Sure.
Altogether. It's a very interesting figure because if you think about it, he's taken a lot of different shapes over the years. Even in that phrase, we hear, you know, see his horns, or he's at your elbow. There's a sort of physical ominous presence, but it's all very uncertain what he actually is. The word devil itself, I found very interesting. It comes from a Greek verb meaning to slander. Which is interesting if you pull it back into speak of the devil, because like you were saying, it sometimes has a negative connotation of you were speaking ill of someone, you were slandering them, and then the one who was slandered happens to come by. So I thought that was kind of a cool little loop in, and I did not know that devil comes from slander. But of course, he has many, many different names. He is biblically known as Lucifer before he's fallen. He is known as Beelzebub. He is known as Lord of Darkness. All these really fun little creepy names for this guy. So when I say Satan or the devil, what image comes to mind?
Well, I would say instantly the image is the classic, the red, you know, red skin, red costume, pitchfork, horns on the head, a tail that's pointed, and that's kind of the classic imagery, right? If there is a Satan, and I know you don't believe in that, and I do, that's not how Satan would look, because if this is a real thing, he's a spiritual being, not a physical being who dresses in a Halloween costume.
Yes. I mean, he could, technically. He does go into costume several times throughout the Bible. Biblically, he is kind of a trickster, shapeshifter kind of person.
Yeah, maybe he would dress in the costume just to throw everyone off.
Like, that would be a good way to do it.
I'm going to show up exactly in the cartoonish way that they think I am. And everyone would be like, ha, you're funny.
Which actually, C.S. Lewis kind of talks about that in the Screwtape Letters. I actually jotted down this quote from this book that C.S. Lewis, the famous guy who wrote Narnia, he wrote this book called Screwtape Letters from the perspective of Satan speaking to one of his demons. Did I get that right?
Well, it's a head demon, Wormwood. Wormtongue. No, Wormwood.
I think it is Wormwood.
Wormtongue is from Lord of the Rings. Anyway.
Okay, so yeah, it's like a higher up demon talking to a lower ranking demon and kind of explaining to him how evil works.
Yes, it's been a while since I've read it. So if I've gotten it wrong and the person he's talking to is Wormwood, that could be as well. Gotcha. Uncle Screwtape. The name of the demon is Screwtape, and he's talking to his underling. He's addressing it to Wormwood, yes. I believe. Because Screwtape is the name of the head demon. Duh, I know. Stop screaming at me. I can't hear you. Well, maybe I can. Maybe that's how I got it. Anyway, sorry.
Sorry, C.S. Lewis fans.
Jane probably knew what that was. Our super fan Jane probably knew that. And she's like, Dave, no.
Jane knows Screwtape. All.
Duh, it's the name of the book.
But in this,
an Australian accent, but no.
Go for it.
Sorry. Nope, not going to do it. It's all you.
So in this book, they do, Screwtape says, the fact that devils, in quotation marks, are predominantly comic figures in the modern imagination will help you. If any faint suspicion of your existence begins to arise in his mind, suggest to him a picture of something in red tights and persuade him that since he cannot believe in that, he therefore cannot believe in you. So that's kind of exactly what you're talking about, this idea of it's a very powerful thing to be like, subvert expectations by meeting them.
Yeah.
So absolutely. As I was thinking about how we picture Satan, this is something I've done some research for in the past, but suddenly the question entered my mind, what kind of angel is Satan? Because we've talked about this before, right? How there's these different breeds of angels and they all look kind of wild and weird and not how they're pictured in most of the art we're most familiar with. You don't see the flannel graph with
if only
angel made of spiraling rings and many wings.
And so, eyes all over them.
Do you know what kind of angel Lucifer was before he fell?
Yeah, there was three. He was an archangel. There is Gabriel, there is Michael, and there is Lucifer were the archangels. And there's, you know, there is cherubim and seraphim mentioned in the Bible. But there are times angels biblically showed up and looked like regular people.
Yes.
You know, like I think Mary, when Gabriel, I believe, came to Mary, I don't think he had all the wings and eyes covering all the wings and, you know, like the super creepy version of the terrifying angel.
Yeah.
But that's my understanding. He was one of the archangels, the three.
Yes. So I saw some conflicting reports between him being an archangel and him being a seraphim. Okay. Archangels, of course, being the high ups. Also, apologies, there might be some background noise. My neighbors are doing yard work and they're not stopping anytime soon, so we're powering through. That's so apologies if any sound quality is lesser than normal. So between these two, there's some parallels between seraphim and archangels, at least physically. Like, I don't know if physically is the right word, but visually. Sure. So seraphim means burning one, which is badass. They're described in Isaiah as having six wings. With twain they cover their face, with twain cover their feet, and with twain do they fly. So basically just a six-winged, hidden-faced, floofy, floaty thing.
Yeah, and if that showed up, yeah, the interesting thing is biblically when an angel shows up, they always have to say the same thing. It's okay.
Do not be afraid. Yes. Yeah,
they say the same thing every time. Don't be afraid. It's okay. And don't worship me. Those are things. Yes. Those are my commands.
Which, yeah. I mean, fair. Because if that comes before you, the first thing you're going to do is scream. And the second thing you're going to do is lay flat on the ground and be like, oh my God, please don't hurt me.
100%. It goes real primal there.
And then in Revelation, they are described again as having six wings each and full of eyes within. They're also described several times in Islam, but they're called bearers of the throne. But it's thought that they're probably equivalent with seraphim, also having six wings, but four faces.
I don't like that.
No, for the whole multiple face thing kind of freaks me out.
Yeah.
And then in the apocryphal book, Enoch, which is not part of like the Bible proper, but we could get into an argument about why certain books were accepted and which ones weren't. They're described as flying elements of the sun who have 12 wings and burst into song at sunrise. So basically just evil robins, maybe not evil, but very scary robins.
Yeah, if those are flying around, we would want to murder them.
Yes. So all that put together, not necessarily about Satan. They're just kind of these vague descriptions of what general angels look like, but we don't even get an idea of what Satan looks like after he falls. We know, of course, that he at one point appears as a snake with limbs mm-hmm. in the Bible, although some people debate whether that was actually Satan.
They do. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he disguises himself as an angel of light at one point. But even if the serpent is Satan, both of these are disguises. They're not the creature itself. So we never actually get a good description of it. We get description of the beast in Revelations, kind of the big dragon creature that rises from the earth. It has horns and it speaks as a dragon. It has a tail that swipes stars from the sky. But again, it's not actually codified that that is Satan. So we get nothing to go from here. But as we know, artists hate voids. They have to fill it with something.
Yep.
So all of a sudden, across time, there's all these different ideas of what Satan could look like. And this kind of becomes a conversation across the ages and across art of who this guy is and what does he look like? Because he's such an evocative creation, right? Such an evocative mm-hmm. character. And so people want to be able to spread the word about him, especially because they're afraid of him. And so they start to depict him. So in the 9th century, we start to see a lot of depictions of Satan coming out. He is immediately drawn with a lot of goat traits. That is like the earliest stuff we can find, a very goat and monstrous heavy creature. It's speculated that because in Matthew, they talk about the parable of sheep and goats, where the sheep are kind of the good and obedient and the goats are kind of this force of evil. It's suspected that that might be why he's depicted with horns, with the little pointy beard, with pointy ears, the tail, all that stuff. Horns, that might be why, because this kind of goat imagery. But it's also possible that, as we know, Christianity is very fond of sweeping other religions under the rug and telling the people who believe them that they're evil. So if we think of pagan religions, how they follow Pan and kind of all these half animal creatures, it's some historians speculate that they decided to depict the utmost evil as these people's gods to help them realize that their gods are evil, which, ooh.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, that thing you worship that actually happens to be the ultimate evil being ultimate of the universe. Evil.
Maybe you should rethink that, huh? Maybe funny you're actually evil.
That bad thing that happened to you, it was probably that being.
Yeah. And probably your fault for not, you know,
almost likely
following the true God.
Yeah. Yeah.
So through this kind of shaping, because art is political, right? And a lot of religion is tied up into politics. And so art becomes kind of this tool. I know, wild. Art becomes a tool to shape the way that these concepts are accepted, especially in a time when literacy is relatively low. These pictures mm-hmm. are going to help spread the message. So it's very important how this guy's depicted, because he is a very important message for this religion. Then things take a bit of a turn a few centuries later when this guy named Dante rolls around and decides to write the most successful piece of fan fiction of all time. So
Dante's Inferno.
Dante's Divine Comedy, the first chapter of which is the Inferno.
Yeah, that's all I know is Dante's Inferno.
Yes,
I forgot it was part of the Divine Comedy.
Yes, it's a three-part. Inferno is obviously the most popular one and honestly the best one. I've read all three and it's the most interesting one because the other one is Purgatory and the other one is Paradise. And both of those are kind of, you know, samey. But hell has all this horrific and like dense, it's all the circles of hell. I studied this pretty extensively in undergrad and it's one of my favorite things because it's so wild that this guy just had a whole bunch of personal vendettas. Wrote a book about them. Basically, he literally wrote people he didn't like from his day and age, from his city, into this book in hell. And it was this whole way to just be like, this guy sucks. I'm going to put him in a burning pit. And I'm going to, because the main character in Inferno is Dante himself being led around by his literary idol, Virgil. And so Dante, in his self-insert fan fiction, is literally walking around and judging all these people who are in hell and being like, oh, that kind of sucks for you. Guess you should have been a nicer person, huh?
Should have been nicer to me.
So this guy does this. And then over the course of time, the Catholic Church and various other religious entities basically go like, oh no, yeah, he was right. That is how hell works.
Nailed it. Like the good in the show, The Good Place, where the one, like, I forget the guy's name. Something. He, like, Doug Foreman or something. He's like, nope, he's the one who had it 100%, almost 100% right. And there's a picture of him on the wall in the office in heaven.
Yes.
Sorry.
It's a similar thing where the church was just like, yeah, that seems about right. We like that it oppresses people. Let's go with it. But very little of what Dante wrote was biblical. And like, we know that now, but it's still very ingrained in the way the church works today. But in the final level of hell, Dante writes about seeing Satan. He actually goes and gets to see the man himself. So I'm going to read just a little excerpt from it so you can get an understanding of how just how dense Dante is to read. The emperor of the kingdom Dolores from his mid-breast forth issued from the ice, and better with a giant I compare than do giants with those arms of his. Consider how great must be that whole which unto such a part conforms itself, were he as fair once as he now is foul, and lifted up his brow against his maker. Well may proceed from him all tribulation. Oh, what marvel it appeared to me when I beheld three faces on his head, one in front, and that vermilion was. So there's just a little piece of it. Basically, he's talking about this enormous being trapped inside a mountain base. It's like a volcano of ice. So he's entrapped in ice with just his torso sticking out of it with three faces. His three faces, three mouths are like roiling forth this like odious misery. And he's holding in his hands three people, Judas, Brutus, and Cassius, the three traitors. And he's gnawing on their heads.
Well, you'd think he'd make short work of them, but I guess not.
So, yes, Dante's Satan is just sitting in an ice bin at the bottom of hell, just eating the sucker lollipops that are the three most famous traitors
of his day.
Yeah. Yes. So here we see this kind of more larger than life and monstrous depiction of Satan. Like artists of this day and extending into the future start depicting Satan like this. There's multiple people like William Blake who depict exactly this. They're like, yep, this is Satan now. He is large. He is encased in ice, but also surrounded by fire. And he has three evil facets to himself. So this became a very popular depiction, obviously not the one we have today. Today, we have a much more human and ability to be trickstery, Satan. And this started to come about because of another Bible fan fiction writer, John Milton of Paradise Lost. Yeah. So John Milton writes Paradise Lost in the mid-1600s. I don't believe it was his intent to do so because he was a very devout man. But over the course of Paradise Lost, he immensely humanizes Satan because he's writing this kind of hero's journey narrative about the fall of Satan and about the beginning of mankind. Satan becomes really relatable in it. Like he just seems like a guy. He's a character. He's not just a force of nature. He is relatable in a lot of ways because it's about defying authority, and he becomes kind of this beacon of free thought, which again, I don't think was Milton's intention because he was really, he was a very religious man, but this really started this human aspect of Lucifer where people started to relate to him, where he was once again depicted as handsome because that is biblical that he was a beautiful angel, but he now becomes humanly handsome, pitiable, and kind of sexy, actually. Like some of the descriptions of Satan seem a little sexual in that book, which who knows, Milton's daughters were the one that wrote it down for him because Milton was blind, and so his daughters were the ones that transcribed it. Maybe they had something to do with that. Who knows?
He'll never know. He didn't know.
Nope. He was just telling his story. But we see this evolve from here in the 1600s to later in the 19th century. We start getting stories like Faust or Mark Twain's Mysterious Stranger, where there becomes this metaphorical Satan. And it's always these trickster characters who are really dandyish and enviable because they're so persuasive and handsome. They're the con man. This is where we get con man Satan. And this is honestly kind of where we end up today in shows like Lucifer or any of those sci-fi shows where there's a Satan character. They're always like devastatingly handsome and just kind of trickstery and
dashing.
Yeah. Exactly. Which, you know, kind of makes sense because they're there to persuade and lead off the path. It becomes less about fear and more about temptation, which honestly is kind of closer to the Bible's description, I would think, because he gets into your head and makes you want things and tempts you rather than just brute force fears you into it.
Right. Yeah.
So all of this kind of coalesces together. I think today we have kind of a amalgamation of all of these different things. We have the elements of the dragon with the red skin. We have the elements of the goat with the horns and the tail, which the tail is also arguably biblical. We have the little, you know, normally he looks very human in today's depictions. So we have that kind of Milton Paradise Lost, but he's also monstrous like in Dante. And he also has a pitchfork.
Right. The pitchfork, because he's going to be like, I don't know why it's not a very effective weapon.
It is not an effective weapon. And honestly, probably not intended to be depicted as a weapon either. So the first time he is represented with a pitchfork, at least that we can like find, is on a cross at an Irish monastery from the 10th century. It depicts the devil with a pitchfork, herding souls away from Jesus. Now, in my mind, Jesus is the shepherd. He does the herding. We picture him with the crook, right?
Yep.
So what is the violent counterpart to the crook, where you're not gently guiding someone, but forcibly piercing them away? I think that's a pretty good bet of where the pitchfork comes from. Is it how he corrals souls down into hell? There's also some speculation that there's something to do with like his own trinity with the three prongs, where maybe it's like his power over the earth, the air, and the sea. And altogether, it symbolizes death because these are all the different ways to die and all that. I like that less.
Yeah, me too.
But I saw it a couple of ways and I was like, you know, that's interesting because three prong thing is evocative, but not necessarily as. I think that the parallel of the crook versus the pitchfork is a pretty powerful metaphor. So yeah, that's how we got from big monster dragon Satan to the little cartoon man.
Yeah, just it's kind of like the little devil sitting on the shoulder and the angel on the other shoulder. They're both very cartoonish.
Which is a trope I love.
Which one? The devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other one?
Yeah, it's just, it's kind of a fun little silly thing that happened in a lot of cartoons when I was a kid.
Yeah, it was quite popular. And it's funny when you actually read and go through the Bible and study it, which to some extent you have and I have as well. And I have a good friend of mine, Daniel Coons, who looked up every reference to hell in the Bible and the language used and went back and did a lot of research. And I grew up with a lot of assumptions, thinking I knew exactly what Satan and hell were. And you go back and I actually look at the verses and there's not a lot of them for one thing, and they're not super descriptive. And clearly some of them, it would seem that they're meant to be very metaphorical and not literal. And so it's tough to go, hey, I know exactly what's going on here. I do believe in that, but I can't tell you that I would have a good description of what those things would be. And I think anyone who tries to make a good description, I can't usually buy where they're going, especially not with the certainty they present it.
Right. Well, especially because the Bible is a book of poetry in many ways, right? It is really ripe with metaphor and with figurative language. And if you believe every word in it, you're missing some of the point. So it's hard to take every element of it as absolute fact, even if you believe in it as a whole, because Jesus loved a metaphor. He told lots of metaphorical stories. Go back to our episode on the Good Samaritan. There's these different pictures he drew that, you know, were not necessarily true, but held truth. And so you have to wonder where else that shows itself in the Bible.
Yeah. And actually, we won't get too deep into the weeds here, but the Bible, if you're really going to study it, you do need to understand that you know, there's, you know, obviously 66 different books. There's a number of different authors all throughout, you know, hundreds of years being written. And, you know, some of it is poetry and some of it's historical and some of it is, you know, apocalyptic literature. And you need to understand when they were writing it that way, or they're writing it that way for a specific intent to communicate to the people of the day, a specific message,
a specific audience.
It was. And now I, you know, most Christians believe that it was also intended for an audience beyond that, but I don't think you then ignore that originally it was written for a specific audience at a specific time within a specific culture. Yeah. And it really helps to understand what that culture is, to understand what the author was trying to say, or maybe even what God is trying to say.
Yeah.
So that's my little sermon.
Well, and keeping in mind that it's been through many, 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 many translations,
yes,
a lot of which contradict each other. So a lot of the information is like fifth hand by this point, and that's generously small. So it's a complicated area of study, but it's really fascinating too, because there's so many different warring inputs on it. Like even Dante, who, you know, he was not divinely inspired. Nobody's arguing that he was divinely inspired. Milton, some people were. Milton, some people thought he was divinely inspired, but that's a whole different thing. But even Dante, who's just this guy, this political satirist of his day, had an immense sway on the way that Christianity is practiced today across the world. He was just one guy who didn't, there's nothing to say that he had any supernatural influence. He had more political
insight.
So it's an interesting area of study. It's really complicated, but kind of tracing how we think of the ultimate evil within the Christian faith. It was an interesting little journey to go down.
Very cool.
Yeah. What stuck out to you?
The main thing is, and this isn't new, but it's something you emphasized in the episode, is, and you wrapped it with, and I think I knew some of this, but you really introduced it to me when you were doing this work for school, of the how much of our imagery of hell was shaped by one man, Dante, who was definitely taking some biblical, you know, some passages in the Bible and really extrapolating and kind of really carrying them up, and then just bringing his own creativity into it, and like why that stuck and like different imagery. So that was just he was just trying to poke at people in his day, and people like, oh yeah, that tracks. That's how it is. And then unfortunately, I think a lot of people who even profess to be Christians haven't done the hard work and the study to know exactly how much the Bible does and doesn't have to say about Satan and about hell. I think it's very illuminating, and you learn a lot doing your own study and going, oh, I was taught this is exactly how it was, but when I look at it, it feels like that's a little bit of a generous interpretation based on this passage. But do your own study, do your own thinking on that.
Absolutely. And, you know, we can sit on the shoulders of giants, as it were, because so much study has been done, and you can really go in depth. Just don't go down any weird YouTube rabbit holes, or you might start believing in the flat earth.
Yes, and other wild things. Then there's no
shortage. Maybe we'll do an episode on flat earth someday. I definitely want to do one on circles of hell. And maybe we'll
really interesting.
We'll talk some about like the flat earther movement or something.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. What about you? What stood out to you?
So I always enjoyed dipping my toe back into sort of the obfuscation of biblical literature and the way that it influences our society. So it was really cool to dip my toe back into that. I really liked learning about the root of the word devil. Wasn't familiar with it. And so it was just kind of nice to get that context. And honestly, the pitchfork thing, had no idea. I hadn't really thought of it when it came up. I was like, wow, that is weird that he has one of those. So learning that was very exciting for me.
Yeah. Very cool. Was that introduced by Milton, the pitchfork, or was that just artwork?
Nope, that was just artwork. Ago? It predates Milton. Okay.
So somebody just was like, hey, what if? And okay, cool. All right. Yep.
So thank you all for tuning in today. We hope you're having a lovely spooky season, and we'll probably have a couple more spooky ones for you after this, leading you all the way up to Halloween. Ooh.
Very good.
Yeah, it will be two more spooky episodes.
And I'm going to give a little teaser for next week's episode. Ooh. We're going to be talking about witches and why they ride brooms.
Wonderful. It's going to get maybe witchy. PG-13 on this one, guys. Just as a warning.
Yeah, a little bit. I'm going to keep it as clean as I can, but there's some stuff. So
yep.
Listen next week and you'll find out what I'm talking about. But if there's little ears around, maybe not for this next episode.
Yep. You can tune into a different one. Although I think a lot of our episodes probably qualify as explicit because I don't have the cleanest vocabulary.
Yeah, no, you don't. It's okay. Yep. That's all right.
Sorry, y'all. Sometimes they're helpful for being evocative. So, you can look forward to joining us for that next week. But in the meantime, if you can leave us a review, that would be super helpful for us. You can do it on your listening platform of choice or on Facebook. We have a group there that you can hop in and see pictures and things related to our episodes. You can thank the writer of our theme song, Tony Gephardt, who is delightful. And if you have any questions, comments, corrections, all that kind of stuff, you can email us at watchyourmouthpod@gmail.com. Anything else?
No, I think you covered it. As always, nice job.
Thank you much.
You're welcome.
Thank you all for listening. We hope you have a wonderful week. But in the meantime, I'm Milo.
And I'm Dave.
Stay curious and carry a hatchet.